You moved to Israel at a very tumultuous time. Is that correct?
Well, I came to Israel for my third year in college, my junior year abroad, which was 1966.
And oh, so you're older than me.
67. Just by years.
Yeah. I just know that was together.
The climax of the year that the university had arranged for us very nicely was a 6-day war.
A 6-day war. Yeah. A small war, which you saw bits of it even in Jerusalem, right? I mean, you were.
Are you kidding? You know how I found out about the war? I was standing on the campus talking with a girl from my program. We were only 137 students from the American program at that time. Hmm. And there were relatively few foreign students. And I'm talking with her on the campus when all of a sudden shells began exploding all around us.
Artillery shells.
Artillery shells from Jordan. Jordanian artillery shells all around us. That's how I found out how the war started.
Oh, my goodness.
And we're standing there like two idiots, right? Gawking. Right? Some Israeli runs by and says, "You stupid Americans, get inside a shelter. There's a war on."
Welcome to Israel. Yeah. Wow. Okay. So that's quite a crazy welcome to study. So from that point on, you thought, man, I want to study biblical studies at this point. What were you studying at that point in your life?
No, I actually, I had come to Israel with a Jewish student, a religious group at the end of, in the summer of 64, after I graduated high school. And we had a wonderful group guide who, everywhere we went in the country, he'd open up the Hebrew Bible, the Tanakh, and he would begin reading to us what it said there about where we were. And it really blew me away. Actually, I'm getting chills just thinking about it, particularly when we went up on the Mount Gilboa range and he began reading to us the 2 Samuel chapter 1, David's lament over Saul and Jonathan. And we're looking around and it's a beautiful, lush valley beneath us and the hills are absolutely bare. And he's reading and he says, and David says, "No rain shall fall on you. Nothing shall grow on you because of how the mighty are fallen." And that's really the phrase is from that passage.
That really got me.
I really have to read the Bible. I have to read more than I'd ever done before, even though I had a very, very good Jewish education up to that point.
Yeah, I think a very surprising thing to my students is when I have to let them in on the dirty little secret of biblical studies is that most biblical scholars are not religious folks, or mildly religious, and that's including Christian and Jewish scholars or Old Testament, New Testament. And so I hear you saying, like, you were actually moved by the text and that this is a real place and you can kind of survey the same scene that David was lamenting from. I wonder, in kind of you've been around biblical studies much longer than me, how much you think the interplay with the reality of Israel in the text features in most biblical scholarship today? Or when you think of your colleagues in biblical studies, how much do you think they're thinking about these issues of like, oh, Mount Gilboa up there where somebody said this, or for them it's just a textual tradition that's been passed on and changed?
Well, certainly Israeli scholars, okay, or people who live in Israel, people who've studied here, which a great many Jewish and actually Christian scholars have studied in Israel at some point. So I think for those people, it's much more alive.
Okay, so you were an undergrad getting shelled by the Jordanians.
Right.
What were you studying, though, at that point? Were you already studying?
I was a Hebraic studies major at Rutgers when I went to college. Right. At the end of my it was a very simple choice for me. At the end of my first year in college, I looked at my grades, and I had one A. I had a D minus in advanced calculus.
Wow.
And I had one A, and I was in the third year of Hebrew literature. And I said, and I enjoyed it. And I said to myself, why should I make things hard for myself? Why don't I just study something I like?
Right.
And then I came my junior year abroad, and I took a Bible course, which was given for foreign students, by Shmayahu Talmon, who was one of the great professors of Bible at the Hebrew University. And it was a course which was on the return to Zion at the end of the Babylonian exile and beginning of the Persian period. Mm-hmm. And he really made the text come alive. It was a seminar course with only 12 students in it, and it was just wonderful. And I took also a couple of other courses. And by the end of the year, I spoke to him about coming back for graduate work after I would go back to Rutgers and finish up my BA. And he said, okay. He said, I'll help sponsor you in terms of the department, get you into the department. And so I came back in 68, and I was here for 7 years, from the 75. And I was doing a few other things. I was part of the time I became an Israeli citizen and went into the Israeli army.
I was going to say that's a long master's degree.
Yeah, but in 75, I received an offer to teach for a year at Dartmouth, and I was on soft money, on a grant. So I was a poor graduate student, so I said, okay, I'll go for a year to Dartmouth, and then I'll come back at the end of the year and do my PhD. Went to Dartmouth, and life interrupted.
and so you were planning on coming back to Hebrew U to do your PhD, but you ended up studying with this kind of lesser known scholar on the West Coast, right? What's his name? You call him Jack.
Yeah. Well, I was very fortunate that when I was doing a master's at Hebrew University. There was a visiting professor from Berkeley named Jacob Milgram, who was, of course, an astonishingly wonderful scholar. He wrote the commentary on Leviticus, which I think is the best commentary.
It's considered the standard commentary to interact with. Yeah,
right. It's not just the best commentary on Leviticus. I think it's the best commentary on any book of the Bible. In the Hebrew Bible. It's just a fantastic commentary. But he hadn't written it yet at that point. He was this was back in the early 70s. And so when I went to Dartmouth for the year. While I was there, I figured I'd go to the Society of Biblical Literature annual meeting, which that year was held in Chicago. And there I bumped into Jack. And he said, what are you doing here? And I said, explained to him my situation. He said, and I had been his teacher assistant. I neglected to mention.
So you had a
I had been his teacher assistant at when he was for the course he was giving for the foreign students there at the Hebrew University when he was on sabbatical. So he said to me, if you want to come and study and do your PhD with me, I'll get you a fellowship to Berkeley. So I had really studied with everybody who I'd wanted to study with in Jerusalem. So it sounded to me like a great idea. And I think it was.
I knew this about you, but I just put it together in my head that you were in Berkeley in the 1970s.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Like, I just now have a different picture rolling through my head of what your PhD was like.
Yeah. Okay. So Berkeley. Berkeley, as an environment at that time, and I don't think it's the same thing today. I'm quite sure it's not. But at that time, it had a greater tolerance for different lifestyles than any other place I'd ever been in my life. I mean, literally, you could walk down the street, and I remember once doing this, walking down the street in at the front of Berkeley and seeing a fashion model with a panther on a chain in the middle of the street in a photo shoot.
All right.
And I'm sitting there amazed, and no one else is looking around. It's like right. People just walking by. It's like, oh, yeah, it's Berkeley.
You know? Yeah. I've gotten to know you through another network of people who are working on Hebraic thought, the thought of the Hebrew Bible. And I remember I think it was when I was living in Jerusalem, you told me, like, hey, I got this idea for a book about the ethics in the Bible. And I remember, I don't know if I told you this, but I remember thinking, like, I don't know, that's a big thorny topic. Like, I wasn't sure if you wanted to handle, I didn't know how capable you were, like that you had this kind of omnicompetence. You can kind of read broadly and figure things out. I thought, like, okay, he's really good in biblical scholarship, but I know a little bit about ethics. I'm not sure if you want that world. And then once you described it, actually, once you sent me the first two chapters and I read them, I remember thinking, oh my goodness, this is good. Everybody needs to read this. And we're going to be posting your lecture on that book. I always get it wrong. Justice for All: How the Jewish Bible Revolutionized Ethics in the Ancient World is the other part. Right. The subtitle I add on in my head.
Right. It's not actually written, but that's really what it refers to. Yeah.
And it's a brilliant book, and it's well written, and it's easily readable by anybody, which is very difficult. I don't think most people realize how hard it is to translate the kind of scholarly discussions into something that anybody could read. And I think you've done a wonderful job.
I really wasn't sure that I could do it when I began writing the book.
It's tough. And quite honestly, I think there's something about your maturity as a scholar that probably contributed a lot to that. I don't think I could write a similar book, even if I had the knowledge you had on the topic. I think maybe in 20 years, I might be able to. Maybe in 20 years, 30 years. Interestingly,
You're a great teacher. You really are.
I try. I play one on TV. Interestingly enough, I was just been reading. I make my class at the end of our Hebrew literature class, which is Old Testament Hebrew scripture. I make them write a letter to their grandparents, just explaining what they learned in class. You know, what was new for them. And a lot of these people are Christians, and so there's lots of things they've never noticed before in the text. And a couple of people came back, and I was really appreciative for it. They basically said, like, I knew there was some rough stuff in the Old Testament. I didn't realize how rough, right? And it really is difficult to watch God telling people to kill people, and watching God be so angry at things that seem such little, you know. And they kind of say, even though we talked through it and I understand, it's just difficult. That's not my picture of God that I was given.
You know, the interesting thing is that there are very few passages like that.
Right.
There really are, but it's like everybody focuses on them. They see those passages and it kind of blinkers them.
Right.
To and see
especially
anything else.
If you're coming from certain traditions within American Christianity, you're just never exposed to the idea that God could be really mad unto death, right? That he's willing to, like, pull the trigger, that he's that upset about things. And I think contextualizing the conversations, walking them through all the texts rather than just pulling out that one text and look at it, it helps. But I had to point out to my students something that I learned from you by reading that book several times, actually, which is this. is just be, it's okay to be worried that God, like be upset that God is doing these things. You know, like you need to feel through that, think through that, reason through that, take some time, take a couple of years and think about that, right? However, you also need to be aware that the reason you're so sensitive to this issue is because you grew up in a culture that has appropriated all those values, that it's wrong to do these things, right? It's wrong to treat people this way. And so the very rubric you're using to judge God is actually one that was handed to you from the Hebrew Bible. And so we just don't want to be naive, and we have to think about how these people can both simultaneously say how good and loving and wise and trustworthy this God is, and at the same time portray him as somebody who actually takes some pretty, what we would consider very severe actions, especially from an American Christian perspective, where it's all God is love, God is love. Love means no anger, no judgment, nothing bad ever happened.
It's compassion, obviously, is a very big part of the Hebrew Bible. I say obviously, even for those who may not have read it well,
right?
But the in other words, justice. Right, I wrote the book Justice for All, but the justice in the Hebrew Bible is not. It's not a kind of a that I tried to describe that exists there, and I try to bring out the passages which I hope I was building this concept on. It's not a what you call harsh or strict or non-emotive justice. It's a justice which also has compassion. And one of the first elements of this justice is that it has compassion for the victim. And that's something which I think that in our society, and I'm talking about, you know, as an American now, because I'm an American and Israeli, mm-hmm. two citizenships. But as an American particularly, I feel that in American society, the victim is somebody who's lost. In other words, the society doesn't rally behind him. The justice, there was a criminal case against somebody who did something wrong to somebody else. The criminal case does not provide any compensation for the victim. The victim then has to go out and sue in order to get compensation. So it's not really part of compensation, it's not really part of the justice for the victim in American society. Yeah. It is in the Hebrew Bible. It is.
And some people might think that it's like, okay, well, it's a small detail where it differs from what's going on in Scripture, but it's actually an immense detail. It really shifts the way you think about the nature of justice itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're going to have much more than that, because we're going to feature again your lecture that you gave at the King's College last year, where they can hear that, and they should actually just go out and buy Jeremiah Unterman's Justice for All to get the full scope of what you argue there. And I think what's unique, unique contribution there, and probably only someone of your scholarly ability could do, is to show, like, look, in the ancient world, I mean, we think of the ancient world as like misogynist, brutal, anti, you know, all classist and tear everybody down and almost like a Darwinist melting pot. And you say, like, no, they had thoughts about these things. They cared about justice, wisdom, mercy, all the compassion. Like, everybody had some thoughts about these ideas. But it's really the Hebrew Bible who developed them into a system of this full orb justice that you describe. Uniquely, and that happens to be the same thoughts and values, even if we don't carry them out in our justice system, it's very similar to what we believe today to be valuable and true.
Yeah, I think the classic example is Hammurabi, right? Hammurabi and the laws of Hammurabi and the laws of the Torah, right? So, in both, I mean, in Hammurabi's the prologue and the epilogue to his laws, and he has 282 laws there, right? So the prologue and the epilogue both talk about that Hammurabi has been charged by the gods to bring justice and to protect the weak from the strong. And you go through the 282 laws of Hammurabi. There is not one single law on behalf of the poor. Not one. And you go to the Torah and you have 50 laws on behalf of the poor and the stranger who's with the resident alien who lives among you, and et cetera, and the widow, the orphan. It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it's striking. And the way you lay it out in the book, it shows just how strikingly different it is on these, what might seem like insignificant, but actually are really cardinal for thinking about the nature of justice again. Well, Jerry, thank you very much for your time. Oh, maybe a little bit, you can give us a little bit of flavor. How's it going in Israel with the COVID problem?
Yeah, it's, well, you know, like everywhere else, I mean, it took us a very bad surprise. But Israel reacted quickly. And I have to say very, very well, despite the fact that the shutdowns that happened very quickly put about a little more than a quarter of the working population out of work. So on the one hand, it's hurt the economy, and even though things are coming back now, because Israel has has a population of 9.2 million, over 16,000 have been infected. Of those, already more than almost 11,000 are over it and have recovered, and 240 approximately have died. I read an article recently by somebody, by a couple of economists, sociologists here, whatever, who wrote that, Israel should have done what Sweden did. And because Sweden didn't apparently shut down, everything was open. And Sweden has about 10.3 million people or something like this. What they didn't say was that 2,700 people have died in Sweden. So we saved 2,400 and some odd lives.
Right.
Then, or whatever, compared to Sweden. And one of the things that the Bible teaches you is that life is immeasurable and it can never be compensated for by money, by economics. So,
which again is a unique innovation in the Hebrew Bible in the ancient world, and one that we hold to today.
And I think I'm proud of Israel doing what it did, because I think we saved a lot of lives, and it's a very Jewish value.
Well, Jerry, welcome to the Center for Hebraic Thought as one of our newest academic fellows. We're honored to have you on board.
It's an honor to be here. It's an honor to be.
We look forward to future
be part of your wonderful center.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jerry.
And I wish everybody good health and happiness from the land of Israel.
Thank you for listening to the Center for Hebraic Thought podcast. Be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave us a review wherever you found us. Want to learn more about Hebraic Thought? Visit our website at HebraicThought.org.